Prime Minister of Iraq is in Washington today on the docket redefining the U.S. mission in his country. Some argue today's meeting is a smokescreen.
Honestly, this is such a weird strategic dialogue because, you know, the main deliverable from it is an agreement that nothing will change.
Also today, half of Australia is back under COVID lockdown. For millions of Australian singles, lockdowns lead to feelings of loneliness.
No one is allowed to visit me, not a single person.
Meanwhile, in Europe, protests break out over vaccine passports. And what do the Tokyo Olympics sound like this year without fans? At the homes of athletes' families, pretty much the same. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here today. A challenge to democracy in North Africa. Late last night, Tunisian President Kais Saied said he's firing the country's prime minister and suspending parliament. This happened after large anti-government protests this weekend. Tunisians are angry with their government's handling of the coronavirus and, generally, an economy in crisis. The president's political opponents are calling the sacking of the prime minister a coup and a threat to democracy. Lilia Blaise is a Tunisian journalist in the capital city of Tunis. Lilia, what's been the reaction to this news in Tunisia today?
So it's very interesting because yesterday night you could see a lot of people going in the streets, chanting, celebrating, honking, and being happy about what just happened because a lot of them were tired about the political turmoil that has been going on for several months now. And then this morning it was quite different. It was quite calm in Tunis. The military was deployed in a lot of places, and especially in front of the parliament, where you could see militaries blocking the access to the parliament and actually also blocking the access to the president of the parliament, Rached Ranouchi, who also happens to be the leader of the Islamist party, Ennahda, and who denounced what happened yesterday as a coup.
So some Tunisians happy that the prime minister is gone, others not. It sounds like things are pretty divided right now. You mentioned how some people are upset by the political elite. Explain that.
It's a general feeling that has been going on for years in Tunisia. Tunisia has known more than a dozen of different governments since the revolution, since the uprising of 2011. And this parliament has not managed to make a prime minister and his government stay enough to actually enact reform. That's I'm describing a feeling people often describe in Tunisia, like the fact that every prime minister in Tunisia is only in power for 6 or 5 months before he's sacked or dismissed. And this is very contributing to the political crisis and the idea that there is no leadership, there is no governance. And it was actually amplified with the pandemic. So that's why people are very tired of the political elite.
For those of us who don't live in a parliamentary system, Lilia, how does this actually work? Does the president have the right to essentially just dissolve the entire government at will?
So the president doesn't have that many powers, especially because before the revolution, Tunisia was under a presidential regime and was considered as a dictatorship, like the concentration of powers led to the dictatorship. So after the revolution, the new parliament voted for a new constitution that put in place a semi-parliamentary regime. So the parliament has a lot of powers, as the prime minister as well, and the president is the chief of the military and has also some prerogatives. But the issue is more with how Kais Saied is using the constitution right now to make his decisions. He's saying he's not doing a coup, and he's right in some ways because he's really using the Article 80 in the constitution that enables him to take power and to take exceptional measures in the case of a very big danger in Tunisia or something threatening the security of the country. And yesterday there were protests all over the country asking for the end of the Tunisian parliament and asking for the resignment of the government. So he basically used that to enact the Article 80. We don't really know how legal what the president is doing.
Tunisians took to the streets, of course, in 2011, triggering there and in other countries what became known as the Arab Spring or Arab Awakening. Tunisia, though, is considered to be the only Arab Spring revolution that was more or less successful in bringing about something resembling democracy. So what should we take away from this latest news?
I think what is positive is that there hasn't been any violence. So there is still this possibility of communication, even if it's very tense. The issue is now, and the worry is, like I said a bit earlier, how much is it democratic to change a political system overnight based on a constitution without the institutions that guarantee the democratic process? And, the absence of a constitutional court is kind of worrying some experts. There is a slight, very fragile frontier between, you know, the president taking action based on the constitution and the president interpreting the constitution as he wants.
Tunisian journalist Lilia Blaise speaking with us from the capital, Tunis. Thank you very much for giving us the latest news, Lilia.
Thank you.
The games in Tokyo are on in a fairly surreal way. Not surreal. China, Japan, Russia, and the U.S. got off to hot starts and lead the medal count. That felt normal. But the medal leaders only tell one slice of the story, particularly at these Olympics. The world's Bianca Hillier is here with me. So people love watching the Olympics to see underdogs come up and take gold, Bianca. We've already seen a few of those made-for-TV moments like that. Tell us more.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the weekend, the U.S. men's basketball team lost to France. Big upset there. But arguably even more surprising was what happened at the men's 400-meter freestyle final at the pool. 18-year-old Ahmed Hafnaoui from Tunisia had just made the finals. He went into the race with the slowest time. But after the first 200 meters, he was looking strong, started inching ahead, and his family was watching back home. I think their reaction will let you know how the race finished.
Wow.
Any guesses from that?
Well, we know he won, but you can really hear it there. And did I see the odds for him winning gold were 5,000 to 1?
Something like that. It was not expected at all. And I spoke with his coach, Joe Brain Tweely, who's in Tokyo with him right now. He actually said they cried when they saw that video of his family cheering. Coach Tweely told me all eyes have been on him since he won.
He was receiving a message from all Tunisian people saying congratulations, and they were saying you made happiness to the Tunisian people. So it was so amazing.
And with the somber political news in Tunisia today, this gold medal must balance things out a little bit. To accomplish that goal at just 18 is pretty incredible. But amazingly, Hafnaoui was not the youngest medalist we saw this weekend, was he?
No, not at all. Over at the women's street skateboarding event, three teenagers swept the podium. It was the youngest podium in Olympic history.
Wow, that's incredible. It was also the first time skateboarding has been included in Olympics history. You know, skateboarders pride themselves for being rebels and not part of the mainstream. Is a place at the Olympics something skaters had been asking for?
Yes and no. You know, there's a lot of excitement about kids seeing skateboarding at the games and thinking, hey, I want to try that. But as you said, Marco, you know, skateboarding has really always been about style and counterculture. And there is this widespread concern that putting it into something as mainstream as the Olympics could kind of take part of that away. Legendary skater Tony Hawk has said skating is about self-confidence and identity, not about competition or judged performances. Pro Alexis Sablon, who took fourth in Tokyo last night, talked to Real Sports with Brian Gubble about this.
There is this like sportification of skateboarding happening, but skateboarding itself is not a sport. It's more, some people call it like a, I don't know, a lifestyle or an art, or all the words sound really cheesy to me. Like dancing, it's like, is dancing a sport? It's physical, but it's also a kind of expression. Maybe it's closer to that.
What about the weather at all these events, Bianca? Tokyo is usually hot at this time of year. What's the weather done to the athletes?
It's impacting them for sure. Those skaters we were just talking about were wearing ice vests in between their runs. But unfortunately, you know, things could get worse here because a typhoon is actually headed in Tokyo's general direction. It could make landfall tomorrow. And archery, rowing, and sailing have already adjusted their competition schedules because of this. Japan's government has not issued any weather warnings yet, but we still could see heavy rain and wind over the next few days.
Wow, so much drama before the games even began. What would these Olympics be without a typhoon? There was Bianca Hillier taking us through the first few days of the Olympics in Tokyo. Bianca, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Several hundred people in California will soon be receiving some money, reparations that the state agreed to pay to women who were sterilized without consent. For decades, a handful of U.S. states had eugenics and sterilization laws on the books. Many of the subjects in California were immigrants and people of color. The world's Daisy Contreras has our story.
Yaneli Bayin says she didn't learn about these forced sterilizations growing up in Los Angeles.
I had only learned about all of these after I had left to college.
Bayin is a public health researcher at the University of California, San Francisco. For years, she's worked to bring reparations to the thousands of women sterilized without their consent in California, many in hospitals, others in prisons. Many of those women were Black, Indigenous, others of Mexican origin.
So as you can imagine, for me, this is something that hit home and was very personal because I'm the daughter of immigrants.
Some relief came this month.
And here's the big one. There are 200.
California Governor Gavin Newsom agreed to include money for reparations in the state budget, almost $8 million. But only victims who are still alive can claim it. That's about 400 people. Activists say many more are out there. Eugenics and sterilization laws were common in the early 1900s across the United States. A lot of it, says Vayin, intersects with U.S. immigration policy at the time.
It contributes to the narrative of how certain communities are viewed as not being fit to parent or be in charge of their reproductive capacity.
It's estimated that 20,000 women were sterilized under California's law. Women like Melvina Hernandez.
Antes de que naciera el niño, el doctor le habló a una muchacha, una enfermera.
This is from the PBS documentary No Más Bebés, No More Babies in Spanish. The film follows the stories of several Mexican-American women who were sterilized at a medical facility in Los Angeles in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
Entonces dijo, porque no vas a firmar, no te podemos operar.
Hernandez says she was asked to sign a form in order to have a C-section. But language was a barrier. She couldn't read what a nurse eventually signed for her. Hernandez says she found out years later that after giving birth, she had also been sterilized. The group of women, including Hernandez, sued county doctors in the state. The judge ruled in favor of the hospital, saying miscommunications led to these sterilizations. But that lawsuit did lead to other changes. California ended its 70-year sterilization law, although sterilizations at women's prisons continued on for several more years. The issue also resurfaced recently at a U.S. immigration detention center.
Yesterday, we learned about a whistleblower, a nurse, working at a Georgia Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE facility.
19 migrant women held at Irwin County Immigration Detention Facility in Georgia.
The women are mostly Black and Latina.
Last year, women detained at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia alleged that they were sterilized without their consent. The Biden administration is investigating. The women also sued. Still, for many people involved in reproductive justice, California's reparations is just a start. Yaneli Bayin, the public health researcher in San Francisco, says she has more work to do.
I don't think that this is the end for me because there are still several issues as a researcher that I've identified that are pushed on certain communities, predominantly marginalized communities.
For now, the timeline is unclear. California says it will cap payment to those who survived these sterilizations to $25,000. For the world, I'm Daisy Contreras.
Coming right up, I speak with our reporter in Afghanistan, where large parts of the country are under a strict curfew.
The Taliban typically uses the cover of nighttime to move around its fighters and weapon. It also uses that time to plant these handmade roadside bombs along highways.
That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Afghanistan, the official deadline for the U.S. to fully withdraw its troops is at the end of August, but the Taliban is already actively on the offensive. The militants have captured more and more territory at alarming speed, and that's prompted the Afghan government to impose a month-long curfew across most of the country. The World's Shirin Jafari is in the capital, Kabul. Shirin, the curfew is not in effect in the city of Kabul, but what do you know about it? Where is it being applied?
You're right, Marco. There is no curfew in Kabul where I am. But what we know is that over the weekend, the Afghan government made an announcement saying that in 31 out of 34 provinces in Afghanistan, there will be a nighttime curfew. Besides Kabul, there are two other provinces that are exempt from this rule, Panjshir and Nangarhar. And this is likely because there is less of a Taliban presence in these areas. Under this curfew, people are not allowed to leave their homes between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m.
So what is the thinking behind this curfew? How would it work to actually push back or dissuade the Taliban from advancing?
I've been speaking with some security experts here in Kabul over the past few days, and what they tell me is that the Taliban typically uses the cover of nighttime to move around its fighters and weapon. It also uses that time, Marco, to plant these handmade roadside bombs along highways. And these bombs are really easy to make and they're really cheap, but they're very powerful. And sometimes when you're driving on the highways, you can see these craters that the bombs have left behind when they exploded. And in some places, what the Afghan security forces do is that they go along the highway in the morning and they clean up these bombs that the Taliban fighters have planted overnight. But as you know, Marco, these days the Afghan security forces are overstretched because they're fighting the Taliban in so many parts of the country. And the thinking here is that maybe these nighttime curfews can help bring down some of these insecurity in some parts of the country. But one major question that I have is, how will this curfew be implemented and enforced, especially in places where the government doesn't have much control or in areas that are contested? I mean, for example, what happens if somebody doesn't follow the curfew in these areas? That's a little bit unclear to me at this moment.
And do the security experts you spoke with, are they concerned that the Taliban will just change their timing and tactics?
Absolutely. The Taliban, Marco, has a very smart, sophisticated fighting tactics. And this is why it's been so hard to fight the Taliban. They are smart. They have support from outside, from what I'm hearing from Pakistan and other places. And it's been very difficult for the government forces to hold them back in parts of the country.
One more thing about fighting the Taliban, Shirin. The U.S. military in recent days has carried out airstrikes in support of Afghan security forces. What does this mean for the American military's role in Afghanistan?
Most of these airstrikes have been targeting equipment that the Taliban has captured from security outposts in various parts of the country. And we're told that these strikes have been carried out by drones. And the general goal here is that, to slow down the Taliban's movement and momentum on the battlefield. Here's what General Kenneth McKenzie, the head of the U.S. Central Command, had to say about these airstrikes at a press conference yesterday here in Kabul.
The United States has increased airstrikes in the support of Afghan forces over the last several days. And we're prepared to continue this heightened level of support in the coming weeks if the Taliban continue their attacks.
Marco, he also said that the Afghan forces face really tough days ahead, and the Taliban are trying to create this sense of instability in Afghanistan. So overall, this is a bit of a morale boost for the Afghan forces who've had really difficult times in the past few weeks here in Afghanistan.
The World, Shirin Jafari in Kabul. Thank you very much for joining us, Shirin.
No problem, Marco.
The Prime Minister of Iraq, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, has been in Washington today meeting with President Joe Biden. They're discussing a change in the U.S. mission in Iraq. Currently, 2,500 troops remain there. Michael Knights is a military specialist with the Washington Institute and has made many trips to Iraq. So there are 2,500 U.S. troops in Iraq. As I said, they mostly serve in training, advisory, and support roles. How is that going to change? What's going to be done?
I don't think the numbers or the location of troops will change at all. But the mission will change from a mission that involves U.S. forces occasionally undertaking combat operations to kill ISIS members to one in which only Iraqis are undertaking the actual combat part of the mission.
So what threat does ISIS, the Islamic State, actually pose in Iraq now? And are Iraqi troops ready to deal with that insurgency on their own?
The campaign in Iraq against ISIS always intended to reduce the threat to the point where Iraqi forces could manage it on their own. And we are at that point now. As long as the Iraqis don't make any serious mistakes in their dealing with the local Sunni population, ISIS will continue to get weaker, even with slightly reduced U.S. support.
The other thing is that U.S. troops have been targeted by Iranian-backed groups in Iraq. Last January, the U.S. retaliated by killing Iran's top general in Iraq, Qasem Soleimani, who managed those groups and was inside Iraq when he was killed. That caused a major strain on U.S.-Iraqi relations. How will a U.S. withdrawal impact the influence of Iran?
Well, the reality is, of course, there is no withdrawal of anything. So, you know, the US and Iraq are seeing this session of the strategic dialogue as a way to change the narrative rather than change the actual level of US presence on the ground.
So let me go back to another question I asked a moment ago. I mean, you've been to Iraq, Michael. You've seen the readiness of the Iraqi forces. Has the US succeeded in its training mission?
The Iraqi security forces are able to cope with today's ISIS, which is just a few hundred fighters spread out. But if ISIS gets stronger again, they will probably not be able to cope with a recovery. So if some ISIS fighters come in from Syria or from Afghanistan or somewhere else, the Iraqi army would still struggle to keep a lid on things.
How would you describe the state of relations between Iraq and the US right now?
The US has been signaling that Iraq is still important as a central location in the Middle East that can either destabilize or stabilize all of the countries around it. So, you know, the US is not sick and tired of Iraq anymore, but we don't want to have combat forces there, and the Iraqis want our forces there to be called something different too.
What are the two sides, the US and Iraq, get out of having met today?
Well, this is an actual formal process called the Strategic Dialogue, which they have to have a couple of times a year. And it's intended to show the two countries are working closely together. So there's a formulaic element to what just happened today. What's different is that the Prime Minister came on this one and he met with Joe Biden. But honestly, this is such a weird strategic dialogue because, you know, the main deliverable from it is an agreement that nothing will change. And that's an extremely unambitious agenda to have.
Michael Knights is a fellow at the Washington Institute speaking about the changing relationship between the U.S. and Iraq. Thank you very much, Michael.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're listening to The World. July 26, usually a red-letter day in Cuba, marking the start of the communist revolution there. This year, dissatisfaction instead of celebration.
These are children of the revolution that are fighting the revolution.
Their parents were true believers. 68 years later, a new generation of Cubans is disillusioned. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Across France, more than 100,000 people took to the streets this weekend protesting vaccine passports. That was the anger in Paris. Similar protests also spread across Italy. In London, thousands gathered in Trafalgar Square, apparently protesting the vaccine itself. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has been following the weekend's activity. This was the second weekend of protests in France, Orla. What specifically are these protesters upset about?
Well, the protesters argue that this new vaccine passport will be an infringement on their civil liberties, is how they're putting it. The vaccine passport, which, by the way, was passed late last night by French Parliament, means that to go to a bar or to a restaurant or to any other entertainment venue in France, the French will need to show that they've either been vaccinated or have proof of a negative COVID test. So on Saturday, prior to the vote, thousands marched through Paris and through other cities in France, as we heard, and they carried these posters with slogans like freedom is being trampled on and stop the dictatorship. Some are also unhappy with the announcement that healthcare workers and carers will have to be vaccinated.
100,000 some odd protesters in France, though. I mean, is President Macron worried about the number of people taken to the streets saying their freedoms are being taken away?
Well, if he is, he's not showing it. He was pretty bullish yesterday when it was put to him that some people felt their freedom was being impinged upon.
Que vaut votre liberté si vous me dites je ne veux pas me faire vacciner, mais si demain vous contaminez votre père, votre mère ou moi-même, je suis victime de votre liberté.
And what he said there is, you know, what's your freedom worth? If you say to me you don't want to be vaccinated and then you go and infect your mother, your father or me, I'm a victim of your freedom. That's not freedom, he said. That's irresponsibility and it's called selfishness. So you can see he's taking a very firm stance on this one. And it does seem to be paying off, Marco, because the majority of the French appear to support his measures. And, you know, the French like to protest, but in terms of the numbers who took to the streets yesterday in comparison what we would have seen during the Yellow Vest protest, for example, there really is no comparison between the two.
Also, over the weekend in Italy, protesters took to the streets. Are they protesting against similar measures?
Yeah, initially they're calling it a green pass as opposed to a vaccine passport, but pretty much it's the same thing. And from August, green pass would be required if you want to, again, eat inside restaurants or cafes. These were some of the protesters on the streets of Turin a couple of nights ago. So they're shouting, no green pass, no green pass. But the Italian Prime Minister, Mario Draghi, similar to Macron, was pretty blunt about the need to be vaccinated.
L'appello a non vaccinarsi è un appello a morire, sostanzialmente.
Essentially, he says, an invitation not to get vaccinated is an invitation to die or to let others die. And in the 24 hours after he made that comment and gave that press conference, over 500,000 vaccination appointments were made in Italy. So they will argue again, you know, that these kind of measures work. But then not all politicians are on board. You had people like Matteo Salvini, the leader of the far right party, the League Party in Italy, speaking out against the Green Pass, saying they're fine for football stadiums, but not, he says, if you want to go and eat a pizza.
And Orla, in London, where you are, I mean, you don't have these mandatory vaccine passports and you're out of lockdown. So why did people show up at Trafalgar Square in such large numbers?
Yeah, many people here are asking the same question, Marco. You did have thousands in central London on Saturday. Many, from what I could see, were holding up these anti-vaccination placards, and they were just pretty much anti-vaxxers. They were protesting against the vaccine itself. Also, by the way, amongst the protesters, there was a big Trump 2024 poster being held sky high. I mean, the protesters say they're protesting against vaccines and the threat of any future restrictions. Where we're at the moment, 1 week on from Freedom Day, is in terms of vaccine passports. The government has said that all nightclubs will need proof of vaccination from the end of September, but so far that's it, although there are reports today that they're looking at introducing them for students going back to university. But any measures like this will meet a lot of opposition, not only potentially from students, but from the universities themselves and from Boris Johnson's own party colleagues, because many Conservative MPs are very, very, very opposed to the idea of anything like a vaccination passport being introduced.
No doubt we'll hear more about that as the school year cranks up. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry in London, thank you very much for your time, Orla.
You're welcome, Marco.
Not so long ago, Australia seemed to be a model for keeping the pandemic at bay. Now about half of Australia is under lockdown. As the highly contagious Delta variant spreads, the state of New South Wales, which includes Sydney, is being hit especially hard. That did not stop thousands of people on Saturday from protesting the lockdown restrictions, and now there's concern that those protests could trigger an even longer lockdown. If there's one group of people for whom lockdowns are especially hard, it's singles, people who live alone without a partner. In Australia, the only visitors singles are allowed are so-called intimate partners. Australian playwright and journalist Melanie Tate has written about the life of singles right now in Sydney. That's where she joins us from. It is challenging, Melanie, to go through lockdowns alone. But can I just ask you what you make of thousands of people protesting lockdowns and running the risk of extending them, making life even more miserable for people like you?
Marco, it was so disappointing to see. It was absolutely perplexing, and it was also really surprising. I mean, I didn't know that there was such a groundswell here in this country against restrictions. I mean, I knew that people were upset about them, that most of us are upset about them and then subsequently playing by the rules because we kind of know that we have to in order to get out of this. And so it was a real surprise to see so many people take to the streets and, you know, flout all of the rules. They weren't in masks. They were doing nothing to protect themselves and the rest of, you know, their fellow citizens. It was so upsetting and disappointing.
If we can, let's talk about your own world, Melanie. You're single. Mm-hmm. You've written about your current situation. If I may be so bold, who is allowed to visit you under current lockdown rules in Australia?
No one is allowed to visit me, not a single person. I can have visitors on under two sort of regulations. I would be allowed to have a visitor if I had an intimate partner, so if I had a sexual partner. The only other time I would be allowed to be visit is if I was in danger in some way and somebody was coming to visit me for compassionate reasons or because my health was in danger. But aside from that, because I don't have an intimate partner, no one is allowed to visit.
What about a family or a relative?
No, that's something that the government is really coming down hard on because the reality of the Delta variant, particularly in New South Wales, is that it's been spreading a lot among families, particularly big families, you know, who are socializing or one person is dropping in and visiting a big family and then they infect everybody. Yeah, we're absolutely not allowed to have family members visit.
So I don't want to pry into your own life, but maybe you can just give us generally a sense of anybody you know who's single who's had a visit like that?
I've heard, you know, jokes and anecdotes about people, you know, trying to hook up with others on the apps, you know, on the dating apps so that they can alleviate a bit of the loneliness. But certainly I haven't heard of that through any of my single friends who aren't dating. Everybody's a little bit too scared to be allowing somebody into their life that they don't know. But certainly, Marco, what's really extraordinary about the way the rules are set here is that that would be legal. I mean, if I started dating somebody on the apps and then decided to bring that into real life and make that an intimate relationship, I would be allowed to do that. Yet I'm not allowed to have my sister over who's been in my life for my whole life or my best friend who I've known for 20 years, you know? It's really extraordinary.
Melanie, how would your life be different if the single social bubble in New South Wales was widened to include visits by friends and family?
Look, I would love it, Marco, if it was similar to what's already going on in another state in Australia, Victoria, and also in another state, South Australia. So how it works is that single people are allowed to nominate one other single person and you decide together that you'll be what's called a single social bubble. I would select my sister and what we would do is we would, after a work day, one of us would go to the other one's house and maybe cook dinner and hang out and watch TV and then go home. The mental health of people who live solo is really at risk. And that's something that we don't want to be paying for down the track, you know, if it's an easy fix now.
Melanie, how long have you been in lockdown and what is the hardest part of living solo for you right now?
So we've been in lockdown, I think, 4 or 5 weeks now. You know, Marco, I usually have a very, very social life. You know, I'm 41 and I make sure that I've got a really busy social life. I'm always out at the theatre or at the cinema or with friends for dinner or coffees and things like that. So I've missed that. But I actually really miss, I have a little niece and nephew who live 7 minutes drive away from me, you know, just a couple of kilometres away. And I usually see them every day and watch them grow and so I guess that's what I miss the most is you know, the relationship aspect of our lives. I'm really missing face-to-face, just hanging out with somebody and not doing anything. I know that sounds really boring. It's not so much the kind of crazy fun socializing. It's the just being around people that I'm really missing.
Like normal times.
Yeah, exactly.
Melanie Tate is an Australian journalist and playwright. Melanie, thank you very much. Take care.
Marco, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Here at The World, our virtual newsroom is always abuzz. Fresh ideas, unearthing details you won't find elsewhere. Join the conversation and share the latest stories. Follow The World on Twitter. We're @The World, or look me up. I'm @Marco Werman. Myanmar's Rohingya people tell stories of a thousand-year history living in Arakan. That's the coast of what's now Myanmar. The government of Myanmar tells a different story, that these same people are foreigners, that they migrated from neighboring Bangladesh. Over the past 4 years, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have been driven from Myanmar by government troops and local militias. They live in dozens of refugee camps in the city of Cox's Bazar, across the border in Bangladesh. Among the few things the refugees still have left are stories. Here's The World's Stephen Snyder.
I'm typing a message to Mohammed Rezawan. He's 24 years old, lives in Cox's Bazar, where it's not easy to get a phone connection, let alone Wi-Fi. I type out my question in WhatsApp.
Where is your home in Myanmar?
About a minute later, his recorded answer comes back.
I'm from Mongolia, kind of state, Myanmar. I'm now living in Kutupalang refugee camp.
Rezawan says he's from Mongdao, Rakhine district in Myanmar, and he's now living in the Kutupalong refugee camp. I got in touch with Rezawan after I learned about a book he's just written. It's called Rohingya Folktales.
We Rohingya people have our own culture, tradition. We are on the brink of losing all of them, unfortunately.
Folk tales, he says, are how Rohingya people teach their youngsters morals and lessons. Rezawan wants to preserve these stories. He spent a year putting his book together. Rezawan doesn't have a car. He doesn't own a bike, so he walked up to 5 miles to meet each storyteller.
It was not that much easy. I mean, really, it was really hard.
He collected nearly 20 stories.
There's the one about the village, the foolish villagers.
Alex Ebsuri edited Rezawan's translations of Rohingya folktales.
An orphan boy is mistreated by some of the villagers, and he decides to seek revenge on them by tricking them into selling all their cows, burning down their house, and then eventually tying themselves to a stake in the middle of an estuary that floods and drowns all of them.
Ebsuri works in international development, and he records the music of exiled groups around the world. He met Rezawan in Cox's Bazar while recording the music we're hearing now by Rohingya refugees.
Folktales are not a universal language. You know, if you read these folktales, some of them are quirky. They're maybe not even the morals that I would think of when I was thinking of a folktale.
Here's one of Rezawan's favorites, about a hunter.
There was once a hunter in a village. One day, while hunting in a valley, he trapped in his net a group of beautiful herons.
And the heron are all trying to escape, and they're flying up and down, left and right, back and forth.
Neither traveling north, nor traveling south, nor east, nor west.
Rezawan says the moral of that story is that birds and people can't go anywhere until they cooperate. Here's another.
The title of the story is A Queen's Dream.
A Queen's Dream.
In ancient times, there was a country that had been badly affected by drought. One day, the queen of the country...
Let me say out front that the queen had a very strange dream. She dreams that the coming rains, if people drink them, will turn them mad. And despite her warnings to the villagers, that's exactly what happens. The place descends into chaos. Rezawan says this story has a moral.
The moral of the story is that if the wrongdoers in the country are majority...
If the wrongdoers in the country are the majority...
They can force entire country... into a very bad situation.
They can force the entire country into a bad situation.
It's what we're facing right now.
What they are facing is discrimination, marginalization. The United Nations described it as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Rezawan told me that he and his family fled Myanmar when their village was set on fire. If life there was untenable, he said, in the camps... It seems like we are facing the second genocide.
I wanted to publish the story in English because I just wanted the international community to know about our culture, about tradition, and about the existence of Rohingya people in Arakan.
In Arakan, the name Rohingya people give to their homeland in Myanmar, a name you can no longer find on any map, a name and its stories that Mohammad Rezwan wants us all to remember. For The World, I'm Stephen Snyder.
Thanks to Alex Ebsery and the Music in Exile Project for providing the Rohingya music recorded in Cox's Bazar. Learn more about Rohingya folktales at theworld.org. In Hong Kong, most university students and teachers are on summer break. For those still at school, there's a lingering fear. The Chinese Communist Party continues to crack down on pro-democracy movements on campus. On July 16th, police raided the offices of the student union at the University of Hong Kong.
The reason given for the raid was that the city's police chief said some of the student union leaders may have breached the national security law that China imposed on Hong Kong in 2020.
Su Lin Wong is the China correspondent at The Economist. She was on today's episode of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at the magazine. She said the trigger for the raid was a statement made by the student union.
They issued a motion that expressed gratitude for the sacrifice of a man who stabbed a police officer before killing himself. And the government said this statement amounted to supporting terrorism. The union subsequently apologized. And its leaders resigned, but the police did not let the matter rest and raided the student union. And local reports say that some of the student union leaders now have exit bans on them, so they're unable to leave Hong Kong.
The Chinese Communist Party has long monitored student unions in Hong Kong. Su Lin Wong says in the past 2 years, two of the most violent confrontations have occurred on university campuses.
In 2019, I remember speaking to my sources who said that Communist Party officials had come from mainland China to Hong Kong to study these student unions. And they conducted extensive interviews with academics in Hong Kong and other residents. And they wanted to know all kinds of details, like how are student union leaders elected and how are these unions funded and what is their connection to the broader democracy movement in Hong Kong. And at the time, I thought that was extremely worrying for the future of these student unions because it implied that the Communist Party was trying to do as much research as possible in order to plan a clampdown in the future. And now that day has come.
That's Su Lin Wong, The Economist China correspondent, speaking about the growing fear of Beijing authorities on college campuses in Hong Kong. She was on the podcast, The Intelligence. In Cuba, July the 26th is sort of a high holiday. On this day, 68 years ago, Fidel Castro's rebel fighters launched the attack that started the communist revolution on the island. Cuban officials typically mark the anniversary with speeches and street parties, but this year is different. 2 weeks ago, thousands of people took to the streets protesting shortages of food and medicine, the overall absence of freedom of expression. And today, few Cubans seem in the mood to celebrate. Former Florida Democratic Congressman Joe Garcia has been watching events in Cuba closely. He's been to Cuba many times since his parents fled shortly after the 1959 revolution. Garcia joins us now from Miami. How is the 26th of July usually celebrated in Cuba? Remind us of the power that is embedded in that date.
This is a day where Fidel Castro and the founders of the revolution, I think there are only five of them left, which were all summarily removed from political power about 2 months ago. But they would all gather and Fidel would give a rip-roaring three-hour speech, which would end with patria o muerte, motherland or fatherland or death. That no longer is happening today. Today, the president of Cuba is doing volunteer work with 100 school children, planting lettuce and other food that people eat on a daily basis in small gardens throughout the country.
So those revolutionaries are gone. Angry protests a couple of weeks ago. What are you hearing from friends and relatives in Cuba about how they're celebrating today?
Everybody likes not working, and today is a day off. But Cuba has now been under the COVID pressure for almost a year and a half. So what used to be a third world medical superpower is now hobbled by their inability and their lack of resources to take on this disease. And it is overwhelming. I was in Cuba less than 2 months ago, and people are kept indoors. People wear masks everywhere. I happen to be a cigar smoker, so whenever you walk by a crowd of more than three or four people, someone screams at you to put on the mask. And yet they're seeing no light at the end of the tunnel, because although you're kept indoors all day, you have to go out and stand in these marathon lines to get whatever food is available. That coupled with the outpouring of violence on the streets where people were demanding change, clearly the government put its boots on and quashed that. But once people have felt their power, it's tough to put a cap on it.
I was going to ask you, so those protests that flared up 2 weeks ago in response to COVID, in response to lack of freedom of speech, et cetera, are those continuing, or has the government actually put that fire out?
Well, the idea to put a fire out is very easy because of Cuba being an island, right? There's no border that you can run to, and it is a very controlled society. But we are seeing for the first time a government that is unable to project its complete and total control of things on the ground. Today was celebrated by these meager rations that were announced throughout the country, which were some rice, bagged rice, a little bit of sugar, and some cooking oil. That was, in essence, the gift that they got today for the revolution.
You've served as a sort of informal intermediary between the U.S. and Cuban governments, Joe. I mean, what are Cuban officials thinking right now? Can you put us in their heads?
But what is stark here for the first time is that these are children of the revolution that are fighting the revolution. These are not the grandchildren of Fulgencio Batista. These are not the remnants of the propertied class or the Cuban kulaks, as it were. This is the children of the revolution. And you notice that both in Cuba, those who are fighting are under 30. And you notice also abroad in the demonstrations that were typically marked by people like my parents or my grandparents standing and fighting for the thought of a free Cuba or a democratic Cuba or a different Cuba. That isn't the people who are taming or taking the streets in the United States or in Cuba. It's right. The youth. It's the people that were brought up in the system.
Today in Washington, there were Cubans protesting, asking Joe Biden to do more, bringing pressure on the Cuban government. So the U.S. imposed sanctions on a Cuban security minister and an Interior Ministry Special Forces unit last week. I gather you've been on recent phone calls, Joe, with Biden officials when they've laid out their thinking on Cuba. What options are they considering?
What the U.S. I think should do is some very aggressive help on COVID that gets directly to the Cuban people, because COVID kills capitalist and communist alike. You know, the Cubans always wanting for an epic battle and seeing themselves in the epic image that Fidel Castro created for this small country, decided to find a cure for COVID. This is something that over half of the G7 didn't even attempt to do. This small country, which is nowhere the top 50 or 100 economies of the world, decided to take on spending hundreds of millions of dollars to try to develop this drug. According to them, they've developed a drug. They simply don't have the syringes to inject people. It's tantamount to buying a Ferrari and not being able to afford the gasoline to make it move.
Former U.S. Democratic Congressman from Florida, Joe Garcia, speaking with us from Miami. Joe, thank you very much for your thoughts and your time.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that is our show for this Monday, July 26th. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.